of you have heard of the Bhagavad Gita. And this title, the Bhagavad Gita as it is a sort of provocative title. Can anyone say why it's a provocative title?
Because it's as it is, there's no interpretation or any translation. It's just, it's as it is, the truest form.
Yes, it's a sort of challenge. The implication is that there are other translation of the Bhagavad Gita that are not as it is, which is the truth. Now, what does it mean as it is? Of course, we know what the English words mean, as it is. But how does as it is apply to a translation of the Bhagavad Gita? As it is means, as Krishna spoke it, Krishna is the speaker of the Bhagavad Gita, and as Arjuna understood it. Arjuna is the audience for Krishna's speaking of the Bhagavad Gita. And in the Bhagavad Gita itself, Arjuna, as the ideal student, tells us how we should receive the knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita from the speaker. And first of all, he accepts Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as the final authority, as Param Brahma, Param Dhamma, Pavitram Paramam Bhavam. And he says that he accepts whatever Krishna has said as the truth in toto. Sarvam etadrite manye. And he further says at the end that he is prepared to act according to Krishna's direction. So that should be our mood in receiving the knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, there are people, Srila Prabhupada called them unscrupulous, who take advantage of the popularity of the Bhagavad Gita, the name of the Bhagavad Gita, to present their own philosophies by interpreting or misinterpreting the words of Krishna. For example, there are some commentators on the Bhagavad Gita who try to say that the Bhagavad Gita is a treatise on non-violence. Now that is a very artificial interpretation, because if anyone knows the least about the Bhagavad Gita, at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna was refusing to fight because of false identification with the body and material attachment. And Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita to convince him that he should do his duty and fight. So how can one derive nonviolence from the Bhagavad Gita? It is completely artificial. And like that, there are so many translations of the Bhagavad Gita in which the translator tries to promote his own agenda in the name of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, we don't mind if people have their own theories. Everyone is speculating and making their own theories. But our protest is that you should do it in your own name. Okay, you have your own theory, nonviolence or whatever it is. You present it in your own name. Don't falsely try to present it as Krishna's philosophy. In 1976, a prominent industrialist in India, Ramakrishna Bajaj, must have heard of Bajaj Electricals, Bajaj Scooters, so on. So he formed an organization called the Gita Pratishtan, or the Gita Foundation. And he wanted to have the first meeting at his family's estate in Wardha. His father was Jamanlal Bajaj, who was a part of the freedom movement. He was the treasurer of Gandhi. And Wardha is quite near Ponar, which is where Vinoba Bhave has his ashram. So Srila Prabhupada did not want to go, because he said that we will discuss how to promote the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, but everyone will have a different idea of what the teachings are. So what will be the use? So he kept trying to decline. And he wrote me a letter saying that I should go in his stead and make the point, very simple point, that if they want to promote the Bhagavad Gita, they should present the Bhagavad Gita as it is. And he gave the example of, well, this is a bit of an adult example, so I hope the parental guardians will take due care, but because I've already begun and it was in Prabhupada's letter, I think I should continue. But he gave the example of a person smoking ganja. And when the police... But he's not holding the pipe. Someone else is holding the pipe, but he's smoking. So when the police come to arrest him, he says, I'm not touching it. My hands are clean. I'm not touching it. So he compared those people to the speculators who concoct their own theories about economics, politics, society, life. But when they're caught for speaking nonsense, I'm not speaking, it's in the Bhagavad Gita, my hands are clean. But their hands are not clean, because they're not presenting the Bhagavad Gita as it is. So, anyway, eventually, Srila Prabhupada came to Bombay, to Juhu, and Mr. Bajaj came in person to and to appeal to him to come. And Prabhupada agreed. So we went by train to Varda, Nagpur, Varda. And there were many prominent spiritual leaders of different organizations of India. And, you know, Srila Prabhupada made the same point that he had advised me to make, which is that they should present the Bhagavad Gita as it is. And he made another point, which is that none of the other people's preaching had really had any tangible effect. So many so-called preachers of the Bhagavad Gita, but their preaching had no significant effect. And Prabhupada was not making the point that he is better than they are or greater than they are. He was making the point that his presentation had effect because he was presenting the Bhagavad Gita as it is. And if they would present the Bhagavad Gita as it is, they would have the same effect. And he took it a step further, that there have been so many translations of the Bhagavad Gita and so many organizations meant to promote the Bhagavad Gita, but the people who are both speaking and listening have not understood the first instruction of the Bhagavad Gita. The first instruction of the Bhagavad Gita is that you are not the body. It's the very first instruction. You are not the body, but you are the soul within the body. Now, there are so many leaders, you know, then, political leaders of India, who were very fond of carrying the Bhagavad Gita and quoting from the Bhagavad Gita. But their purpose was political. And politics is based on the principle of friends and enemies. And on a deeper level, it's based on false identification with the body. So they are carrying Bhagavad Gita, addressing hundreds of thousands of people, quoting from the Bhagavad Gita. But they are identifying with the body. They're absorbed in thoughts of friends and enemy. You know, so-and-so Zindabad and so Murdabad I am not the body. They haven't understood the first instruction. And Srila Prabhupada made the point further that his disciples, foreign disciples, had understood the Bhagavad Gita. And therefore they were so many from different nations, different backgrounds, different communities, living together and working cooperatively to serve Lord Krishna. So they understood the Bhagavad Gita, and they were actually living the Bhagavad Gita. And again, Prabhupada attributed that effect to one thing only. which is presenting the Bhagavad Gita as it is. If you present the Bhagavad Gita as it is, it has effect. Krishna's words have potency. And one who receives the Bhagavad Gita as it is, he knows he's not the body. He doesn't identify that I'm Indian, I'm Russian, I'm Chinese, I'm British, I'm American, or I'm Hindu, or Muslim, or Christian, or Jewish. But he's spirit soul, part and parcel of Krishna. And as part and parcel of Krishna, his natural function is to serve Krishna. Our natural function is to serve in any case. But when we are full of these false designations, our service is directed in a different way. If I think I'm Indian, then I will want to serve India. If I think I'm Pakistani, I want to serve Pakistan. So I have to serve. That is my... I'm meant for that. I'm created for that. But when we have these false designations, we serve false conceptions. And who knows what you'll be in your next life? You may be absorbed in thinking, I am Pakistani, I hate India. And then in your next life, you might take birth in India. And think, I'm Indian, I hate Pakistan. So these are all artificial, illusory. So, so this is the Bhagavad Gita as it is. And I am going to read one verse from the Bhagavad Gita from the beginning on this very point that that we just discussed. Please repeat after me. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Please repeat. Dehina.
Dehina.
Asmin.
Asmin.
Yata.
Yata.
Dehe.
Dehe.
Komaram.
Komaram.
Yovanam.
Yovanam.
Jara.
Jara.
Tata.
Tata.
Deha.
Deha.
Antara.
Antara.
Prapti.
Prapti.
Dira.
Dira.
Tatra.
Tatra.
Na.
Na.
Muyate.
Muyate.
Translation. As the embodied soul continuously passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. Please repeat. As the embodied soul,
as the embodied soul
continuously passes,
continuously passes
in this body,
in this body,
From boyhood.
From boyhood.
To youth.
To youth.
To old age.
To old age.
The soul similarly.
The soul similarly.
Passes.
Passes.
Into another body.
Into another body.
At death.
At death.
A sober person.
A sober person.
Is not bewildered.
Is not bewildered.
By such a change.
By such a change.
So this is a very important verse. This is the first line, or the first instruction of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, we all have experience that when a person is born, he or she has a baby's body. But after some time, that baby's body is no longer there. Then there's a youth's body. And after some time, that youth's body is no longer there. There is an old person's body. But the soul or the person is the same. Is the sound all right?
There's some coming through that much.
Huh?
A little more volume.
There's some feedback. We just have to call. So we're keeping it down.
But can't we do something about the feedback? So when someone is a young person, say someone's an old person, so he has a different body than when he was a young person. He remembers, I used to run and jump and play, but he can't do that anymore. But he remembers, I used to run and jump and play. That means the I is the same, but the body has changed. And at every moment, the body is changing. It's never exactly the same. Now, some people will say, well, the body hasn't changed, it has grown. But that growth is really an illusion. It is a word that we use to describe a series of changes. Just like with a motion picture. When you see a movie, you see a man is running across the screen. But he's not running. What you're seeing is one image, then another image, slightly different, then another image, slightly different, another image, slightly different, in quick succession. So there's the illusion of a person running. But there's actually no movement. It's just a series of different images. So when we say the body is growing, it's not exactly growing, it's just a series of different bodies which we say has grown. But actually, it's changed. It's changed. Of course, you could say growth is a type of change. But that the word growth suggests that the body that I had when I was born has grown into this body, but it hasn't. This is a different body. I think all the cells change every 7 years. It's a different body. But I'm the same person. I remember I used to be young and I used to be able to do so many things that I can't do in this body. So just as the soul passes through different bodies during the present life, similarly, at the time of death, the soul passes into another body. It's just an extension of the same process, which is the soul is passing through different bodies, even in this lifetime. And at the time of death, it also passes into a different body. That means that I, the person, am different from the body. And we say my body, my head, my toe, my arm, my leg. It's mine. But who am I? Who is the I that is claiming to be the proprietor of this head, toe, arms, legs, and so on, even mind? I changed my mind. My mind is bothering me. So that I is the soul. And that soul, according to the Bhagavad Gita, is part and parcel of the Supreme Soul, or Krishna. And therefore, its natural function is to serve Krishna. Like the hand is part and parcel of the body. It's the natural function of the part to serve the whole. So as spirit souls, it's our natural function to serve the Supreme Soul, or Krishna. And that will make us happy and satisfied. Right now, practically no one is happy or satisfied because they have made a fundamental mistake in the very beginning. Just like if you're performing some mathematical calculation, if you make a mistake in the very first step, even if you perform all the other steps perfectly, you may get further and further away from the actual answer. So in the same way, if you make a mistake in the beginning by identifying with the body, and thereafter you do everything perfectly for the benefit of the body, you may get further and further away from the actual goal, which is happiness. And that is the truth. And in fact, in the last 10 years, there has been a whole new field of psychology to deal with the question of what makes people happy. And the reason is because there's a whole generation of people who have done exactly what they were told would make them happy. They got a good education. They got a good job. They married a qualified spouse. They earned a lot of money. They got a nice house, got a nice car, went on holidays. They did everything that they were told would make them happy. But they didn't become happy. So now there's this whole new field called positive psychology. What makes someone happy? And this research has turned up some very interesting, maybe even startling, discoveries. They have analyzed that there are basically three factors in a person's happiness. The first is his, you could say, base point. They call it his base point. His natural tendency to be happy or unhappy. And they say 50% of one's happiness or unhappiness depends on the base point. Now, the base point can be translated in scientific language as one's genetic disposition. But in the language of the Bhagavad Gita, and the two are not incompatible, in the language of the Bhagavad Gita, we could translate it as one's karma. And even if we say that it's someone's genetic disposition, still, why does someone have a genetic disposition to be more happy? Some people are naturally more happy, more cheerful, and other people are naturally more morose. It's naturally more depressed. So that's 50%. That's already fixed. Then another factor is the condition, the conditions of one's life, which are the geographical place where you live, the dwelling that you inhabit, the place where you work, everything that makes the conditions that one lives in. And it has been found that between 8% and 13% of one's happiness is affected by the conditions. Say roughly 10%, average 10%. Yet we put so much effort into changing our situation. We want to move to a better location, better house, get a better job, and that hardly affects our happiness, which is the ultimate goal of all of our endeavors. And this truth is also contained within the Vedic body of knowledge. There is a verse in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam and a similar verse in the seventh canto of Srimad Bhagavatam that says that just as misery comes without our making any endeavor. Now, how many of you endeavor for misery? No. How many of you go to the temple or church or mosque and pray, "Dear God, give me some misery"? No one. But we don't try for it, we don't pray for it, but it comes. It comes without our not wanting it, but it comes as a result of our karma. We are destined to to enjoy a certain amount of happiness and to suffer a certain amount of distress. So the Bhagavatam says, just as miseries come of their own accord without our endeavor, similarly, happiness will come of its own accord without our endeavor. Now, this principle is there in Vedic culture, in Indian culture. Person anyway, there are many examples, but there's a saying that Srila Prabhupada used to quote. Yeah. I mean, at concerts, they don't let people come and go. It completely disturbs. You know, this is very important. So, there's a saying that even if you go to Calcutta, your forehead goes with you. Because in the old days, Calcutta was the most magnificent city in India. So people from all over India, they thought, oh, if I go to India, I will earn my fortune. So there was a saying that even if you go to Calcutta, your forehead will go with you. Because one's destiny is supposed to be written in one's forehead. And even today, when Indians want to lament their bad luck, they go like this. I'm so unfortunate. I almost got it. I'm so unfortunate. I just missed. Because it's our destiny. Whatever happiness is destined, even if we go to Calcutta, it will follow us. Whatever misery is destined, even if we go to Calcutta, it will follow. Or Houston, or New York, or Toronto. It's the same thing. So, that 10% that is the focus of most people's pursuit for happiness is just 10%. It doesn't affect much. So that leaves 40%. 40%. So what is the 40%? The 40% are things that we do well that produce a sense of inner satisfaction. You know, it's something that we are meant to do, and when we do it, it creates a sense of inner satisfaction, and that lasts. They did one experiment that had some of that, and then something that just makes you happy in terms of your sense enjoyment. For I think in the experiment, it was eating an ice cream cone. So eating an ice cream cone will make you happy. Do you like ice cream? Yeah. It's hard to get their attention, but now we finally got the right level here. You like ice cream?
You're lying.
So the people in the experiment who were interviewed Like immediately after eating the ice cream cone, felt happy. But that happiness did not last long. Sorry. She looks disappointed. You could have another one, but that won't last long either. And how many can you have? Whereas something that is a matter of, you could say, discipline, produces a sense of happiness or satisfaction that endures till the next day. This is all material things, but till the next day. And that is also described in the Bhagavad Gita, that there is happiness in different modes or gunas. There is the mode of ignorance, tamagun, a mode of passion, rajagun, and mode of goodness, sattvagun. So happiness in the mode of passion is like nectar in the beginning, but poison in the end. We know that. Say overeating. Overeating. When you're eating that delicious food, you feel happy. Or drinking. Of course, there are many other things I could comment on about the art car parade. It was wonderful, and I will comment on it, maybe not here, but it was really wonderful. But one corollary of going out in the art car parade is you see what people think, part of the way you see what they think is by what is written on their t-shirts. So there was a fellow who had a t-shirt that said, "You look like I need a drink." Now, of course, that's sort of a play on the usual, like, you look like you need a drink, like you're not doing so well. But this one is, you know, you look like I need a drink. Like, well, I guess I have to have a drink. So this type of happiness is like nectar in the beginning, but poison in the end. Because the next morning, it's like even my psychology professor used to say, "What do you do when the orgy is over?" So now, There's like a whole field of activity that has been found to be the most efficacious in producing happiness. And that is doing good for others. My cousin is a family therapist, and he was sort of typical American skeptical type of person. But even he has had to admit that the findings in the research show that people who do good for others become happy. And people who are unhappy, if they dedicate themselves to activities that are good for others, they become happy. More than by sitting and, you know, discussing problems and whatever the different other approaches are. And in terms of job satisfaction, the jobs that sort of do more good for others, or I wouldn't even comment on whether they do good for others or not, but in which the person has a feeling that he's doing good for others. His motivation is to do good for others. Their job satisfaction is very high. Like religious leaders. I mean, not... Yeah, I think teachers, healers. And then they discovered one thing that it's like off the charts. It's like so potent. It's literally off the charts. I mean, it was when they were first conducting them. Now they've probably recalibrated the chart. And that is, they have located areas in the brain that are associated with happiness. And that at times of happiness, the brain waves in those areas are very pronounced. And they have their way of mapping the brain. So they've done experiments, you know, linking electrodes to the person's brain and mapping those brain waves associated with happiness with different activities. And they have linked, they've done experiments with devotees. But not just devotees, even Buddhist monks, but also devotees, chanting. And when the graph went like totally extreme. I mean, they had not mapped anything that you showed that extreme height of brainwave associated with happiness as chanting. That applied both to japa, Hare Krishna, Maha Mantra japa, and Gayatri Mantra. And they even say that process can reprogram the brain so that it's that base level that we began by talking about, that base level changes. I mean, the base level by definition doesn't really change. It doesn't change by changing your condition, and it doesn't change by changing your work or other activities, but it changes by that. So, but of course, the sages of ancient India knew all these secrets before. You know, it's not that we need to read articles, read research about what makes people happy to know the answer. But we read it because it gives confirmation to the truths that are already there in the Bhagavad Gita. And for people who tend to put stock in, you know, science and mathematics, it confirms the truths that are already there in the Vedas. Many years ago, I mean, now it's probably, I can't say for sure, maybe like 70 or 80 years ago, there was a conference in India. probably in Calcutta, at which some Europeans, maybe Americans and Europeans, came to discuss with some Indian saintly persons. And this Western scholar was astonished by the knowledge in the Vedic literature. And at the end, he exclaimed that, you know, you people have such priceless knowledge. Why didn't your forefathers share that knowledge with our forefathers? And the saintly person replied, because when our forefathers were compiling the Vedic scriptures, your forefathers were swinging in the trees. Well, actually they weren't, but it just shows the folly of the theory of evolution, that they think that the people who compiled such profound truths in the Vedas, by their calculation, you know, so many years ago, decades, millennia, were monkeys or some descendant of monkeys. So actually, this is real knowledge. And as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, anything else is ignorance. Krishna lists so many items that are knowledge. And then he says that anything else is ignorance. So most of what passes as knowledge in educational institutions by the standard of the Bhagavad Gita is ignorance. The first two items in the process of knowledge are amanitvam adambitvam, humility and pridelessness. To have knowledge, you have to be humble. To get genuine knowledge, you have to be humble. And where is that? But the two most important items are engaging in devotional service to Krishna. That's the most important of all the items. And then next most is acharya opasana, that one must approach an acharya, a wise teacher. And Krishna says, anything not in this list is ignorance. So this is the situation, that most of what is being taught is ignorance. Ignorance of the identity of the soul and the goal of life and the means to attain it. And Srila Prabhupada would protest, where is that department in any educational institution that teaches the difference between a live body and a dead body? He gave a talk at MIT, and this was his question to the students and professors. Where is that department that teaches the difference between a live body and dead body. They don't even know. They're so ignorant, they don't even know. When the soul leaves the body, everything in the body is there. All the organs are there, all the chemicals are there. But what makes it dead? Well, the soul is left. I mean, actually, the body is never alive. It's always just a bag of chemicals. But it appears to be alive because of the presence of the soul. So they don't know that. Most basic fact. Now, I'm aware that our hosts have entered the medical profession, and perhaps there are others here involved in the medical profession or aspiring to be. And there's, which is all well and good, there's no problem at all. But there's a verse in the Bhagavatam that says that even if you have a very strong boat and a good captain, you may drown. As was the case with the Titanic. Recently they were observing the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. The most popular movie of all time, the biggest grossing movie of all time, the Titanic. They re-engineered it so it was 3D at a cost of $18 million. Dollars. Yeah. 18 something. Yeah. Anyway, so the verse says, even if you have a very strong ship and a good captain, still you may drown. And it says, even if a child has very good parents who are very attentive to the child's welfare, still the child may die. And even if a person has a very good doctor and very good medical treatment, still he may die. So there's four lines. So these are three. The fourth line is that unless one is cared for and protected by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In other words, the ultimate factor in one's life or death or happiness is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the verse says that unless one is cared for and protected by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even if he has a strong boat and a good captain, he can drown. Even if he has a good doctor and good medicine, he can die, and so on. So we, in whatever activity we engage, we should be aware that the ultimate factor is the Supreme Lord. And this is also known in the Ayurvedic system of medicine. I'm fortunate to have a Vaidya, Ayurvedic doctor, who comes from a long line of Vaidyas that is traced back to the time of Krishna, before the time of Krishna, mentioned in the Puranas. And he explained that there are three categories of Vaidyas or doctors. The lowest category doesn't know what he's doing. And the recommendation is to avoid him. The second category knows how to diagnose a disease and treat it, but he cannot explain it to the patient. And you can take treatment from him, but the problem with his not being able to explain it is that there's two problems. One is that a person won't have the conviction to follow all the prescriptions because he won't understand why he's being asked to follow. And the other problem is that if the doctor's not available and something comes up, he won't know how to deal with it. He'll be completely dependent on the doctor because he won't have learned the principles underlying the doctor's recommendations. And then the first category, you know, he knows how to diagnose and treat and explain it. But the name of that, they're Sanskrit names for all the three categories, but the name in Sanskrit for that category is someone who can intercede on your behalf with God. And the idea is that along with the diagnosis and treatment, he can intercede on your behalf with God. In other words, he can pray to God. On your behalf. We were just discussing different levels of Ayurvedic practitioners. She's somewhere in there. And he told me that his father, I mean, because of now the government regulations in India, for Ayurveda you have to go to like a government approved Ayurvedic college. But the real knowledge gets passed down through parampara, through these genuine lines of parampara. But so anyway, so he went through all that, and then after he finished that education, then he had like personal training from his father. And that's where he learned most of what he uses. And he said that if his father had a case that he could not treat, he would tell the patient to chant Hare Krishna. And the, of course, in some cases the disease cleared up by chanting. In some cases it didn't. But in any case, the person benefited by chanting. But in a lot of cases, it did clear up by chanting. And they have certain rules, so many rules. Like they're forbidden to accept a patient that they think they can't help. Anyway. So, many principles they have. And that's a big problem with Western medicine, that I shouldn't say Western, but everywhere probably, that the doctors don't want to admit defeat. They don't want to tell the patients or the family members of the patient that they can't do anything to help the patient. And the result of that is devastating on the patient, on the family. I mean, spiritually, emotionally, even financially. They don't want to tell them. They don't want to tell them. There's a whole field of hospice care that's meant exactly to help people make the transition from this body to the next. And it's covered by Medicare. But something like something like 98% of people on hospice go on hospice and die within 3 days because the doctors don't want to admit. So they keep trying this, that. And another study has shown, ironically, that the patients who are told that they have a terminal illness and are no longer fighting it, trying to be cured, and who go on hospice, they end up living longer than the people who keep trying to prolong their life, you know, fighting it. So there are like so many anomalies. And, you know, all the answers are in the Vedic literatures. And again, as, you know, science or research is exploring more subtle areas of human existence, like happiness or end of life, they're finding that what the sages of India, what the Vedic scriptures said, are true. So it's good if you can help someone medically. But ultimately, everyone will die. Bhagavad Gita says, for one who has taken birth, death is certain. And for one who has died, birth is certain. We can't avoid it, as sure as death. So we should live our life in such a way that we'll be happy not only in the present life, but in the future life. You know, we're talking about immediate, like poison, nectar in the beginning, but poison in the end, or poison in the beginning, nectar in the end. Well, Krishna consciousness, bhakti yoga, can bring you to happiness that never ends. It exists in this life and it continues into the next life. In fact, the distinction between this life and the next life hardly exists for a devotee, because he'll be happy serving Krishna in this life, he'll be happy serving Krishna in the next life. So it's immaterial to him. We didn't read it, but there's another verse that compares the change of body to the change of dress. It just has no significance. You're wearing one set of cloth, it becomes old and useless, you discard it and put on a new set of cloth. But you're the same person. So all these truths are there. And they can be realized very easily by bhakti yoga. And the process of bhakti yoga, the most essential process, is very easy and joyfully performed, and that is the chanting that we did. This is so easy. You don't have to do any gymnastics or severe austerities or any word jugglery. Just chant. And that chanting has so much potency that it cleanses all the dirty things from the heart, that misidentification with the body and conception of I and mine, and I am this body, this is my husband, this is my wife, this is my child, this is my home, this is my car, this is my community, this is my nation. That's all cleansed by the chanting. And anyone can do it. Even a child can do it. Mira, you were sort of lukewarm about ice cream, although Rasikendra had his own interpretation. How do you feel about chanting? Good, good. You liked ice cream. How do you feel about chanting? Good. And how do you feel about chanting? Good. And do you all know the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra? Do you think you could say it together in unison? Okay, let's hear.
Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Thank you.
Hi.
So the point of this demonstration is that even a child can chant. It's universal. Even a child can chant and feel happy. And I've heard from some of these children who go to our Sunday school that the highlight of their week, which they look forward to all week long, is going to the Sunday school. So that says a lot, that it's easy and it's a joyful process. Anyone can do it. So the conclusion of our message tonight is that you should accept the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita as it is. And the Bhagavad Gita is the essence of the Vedas. If you understand the Bhagavad Gita as it is, you understand the essence of the Vedas. But it includes other books too, like Srimad Bhagavatam, most important. And you should apply this process. It's mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. And especially chant. Chant and associate with devotees. And take prasad. We will be coming to that. That's also part of it. Important part of it. We won't take a survey of how many people like prasad, but you can take it on my word that everyone here does. So, let us repeat once the Hare Krishna mantra. You can repeat after me. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Krishna Krishna.
Krishna Krishna.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Rama Rama.
Rama Rama.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
That was good. Now let's do, that was two words at a time. Let's do four words. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.
Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare.
Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama.
Rama, Rama, Hare Hare.
Rama, Rama, Hare Hare.
Very good. Let's do eight words. Wow, that's a lot of words to remember at a time. But we're in high IQ realm here, so I think they can do it. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Very good. Yes. So we'll do all 16, and then we'll do something else. Okay. So this. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Excellent. Give yourselves a big hand. Now, in the beginning, of course, not everyone was here. In the beginning, we asked how many people do not regularly chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. There were a few hands. You were one of them. You were one. And you were one. Now, after this little exercise, how many of you can chant the full mantra from... Well, you can all chant two words. Okay. So, how many of you can, you think you can chant the first half at least? Okay, we'll just go down the line.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Good.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Ah,